When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
You are listening to Two Creepy Bees, a podcast where two sisters obsessed with the macabre talk spirits, urban legends, aliens, and the occult. Essentially, anything that tingles your spines and bumps your gooses. I'm Bethany.
And I'm Bailey.
And we're your two creepy co-hosts.
Creepy.
Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome back, creepies.
Yes, welcome back to another episode of Two Creepy Bees.
Yep.
First, I want to say thanks for your patience with us in our little hiatus for Bailey's B-Day.
And yeah, B-Day Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and then I passed my master's thesis defense. And so,
Woo! Yay!
And so a lot of cool things have been happening. Bailey got to celebrate her birthday, got to go take a little trip.
Yeah, we had a, I'm going to call it a safe trip. It was a very safe trip. We went and stayed at a cottage near Zion, and we were so fortunate to not run into, like, almost anyone while we were hiking. So it was a beautiful and very relaxing birthday / Thanksgiving.
Yeah. That's, like, about as safe as you can be when it comes to traveling. You just go around, no people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is the way you want to do it anyway.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's why I like hiking vacations,
because
it's not like the touristy spots that, like, you know.
Exactly. Like, I feel you the same way. I don't want to go on a vacation in a city.
Yeah.
But that's besides the point. Yeah, so we had a lot of fun things going on and a lot of crazy things going on. Things have been very busy for Bailey's work, and then I was busy trying to finish graduating, which still not officially graduated, but I did the
She's
hard
pretty
shit.
Close. Yeah, She's I'm pretty close
there.
Now.
I'm getting there. I am a master of bees and...
Hormones?
Really just one
Bee
hormone.
Hormones.
Just one hormone.
Cortisone?
Cortisone.
Ah, I was right. When I was trying to tell my boss about what hormone, because she asked me, she was like, so what hormone is it? I was like... Cortisone, and she's like, cortisol. I was like, no, it's not cortisol, because it's like the B version of cortisol.
It sounds like it, but it does, like, not do the same thing.
I was like, it's cortisone. Sounds right.
You said cortisone?
Maybe.
It's cortisone.
Whatever.
Close enough. It doesn't matter. Who cares? Who cares besides me and a few other people out there?
All your B friends are so upset right now.
Sorry, it's fine. I care about bee hormones. But anyway, you guys probably don't. So today we actually kind of have another, it's kind of like another unsolved mystery type thing.
Yeah, not really paranormal, although some people have tried to apply paranormal instances with this mystery.
But it's really not. But it is still really cool. Quite tragic.
It's very, it's a tragic story, and I think what really gets people is just the mystery of it all.
Absolutely.
So why don't you go ahead and tell us what we're talking about today?
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking to you about the Dyatlov Pass incident, the famous incident where nine hikers died under mysterious circumstances in the Ural Mountains. It's been one of those things that people have just been scratching their heads over for decades, and there might be some closure as we'll kind of reach at the end, but you know, I'm really excited to talk about this. This is something that's really captivated my imagination since I was a little younger. Granted, I probably didn't fully understand it, right? I thought it was more paranormal.
I definitely am excited to talk about the theories, because I'm going to talk about my theory as a like when I was younger and what I thought it was.
Yeah, same. But still, it's really fascinating. And I mean, like, why don't we just get into it? Because we're gonna go through a background about, like, the purpose of the expedition, mm-hmm. where they traversed, what it was like, mm-hmm. then the investigation, and then theories, right? So, mm-hmm. so it's a pretty dense episode. So stick with us. It's like, there's a lot of facts, but it's really cool,
right? And we really only scratched the surface yeah. of this story. Mm-hmm. A couple things we want you guys to keep in mind as we talk about this story is that all nine people mm-hmm. Involved in this tragedy were just that. They were people.
Yeah,
exactly. And they had loved ones and families who their lives were changed, you know.
Forever, absolutely.
So we couldn't go in as in-depth as we would have liked to kind of get mm-hmm. background on who these people were. Mm-hmm. But there is a ton of information out there.
Tons of great books.
Absolutely.
Articles, yeah.
We'll let you know some of the sources at the end of the episode if you're interested in learning more. But we mm-hmm. really only scratched the surface. Just remember that these people, they were people. They were human beings. And this is a really tragic story.
Absolutely.
The second thing we want to say is...
Oh, God. All right.
This is Russian, guys. And oof. You know how good we are at pronouncing things.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be... I apologize in advance. I'm going to do my absolute best. But mm-hmm. I think I have some of the pronunciation down, but it's going to be... I'm going to have to say it real slow.
We were practicing before we started, but...
We're going to do the best we can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please bear with us.
So with that in mind, Bethany is going to kick us off.
Oh, God. Here we go. Okay. Yeah. So... I'm going to start us off with a bit of background, right, just to take you back to the time and place, right? So this takes place in Sverdlovsk Oblast, Soviet Union, in 1959, or it is now known as Yekaterinburg, Russia. So we're going back to the Soviet Union in the 1950s/60s, okay? So at this point in time, the Cold War is reaching its climax, which, as we know, was a period of open rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. So the United States and the Soviet Union began developing intercontinental ballistic missiles, but ultimately this battle was really waged using politics, economics, and propaganda that pushed the two superpowers to the brink of nuclear destruction. So, needless to say, things were very tense in the Soviet Union, and of course in the United States too. And the powers that be in the Soviet Union wanted to present the Soviet Union as an unflappable superpower. So this created kind of an air of secrecy surrounding the government's dealings. So I just want you to keep that in mind and keep that place and time in mind when we go through specifically like theories in the investigation.
Right.
And I think a lot of the secrecy surrounding the Soviet Union at the time really led to some of these conspiracy theories. But we'll talk about that all. I just want to let you guys know that's a little bit of what's going on in this area.
That's the setting.
Okay, so Igor Dyatlov was a 23-year-old radio engineering student at the Ural Polytechnical Institute, which is now the Ural Federal University. So probably a very smart person studying radio engineering. And Dyatlov was the leader of a group that had been assembled for a skiing expedition into the Ural Mountains. The group consisted of nine others. Yuri Doroshenko, Ludmila Dobininya, Georgi, or as he liked to be known, Yuri Krivonoshenko, Alexander Kolevatov, Zenaida Komogorova, Rustim Slobodin, Nikolai Thibault-Brignol, Simon, as he liked to be known, Alexander Zolotaryov, and Yuri Yudin. Most of whom were fellow students and friends at the Ural Polytechnical Institute, or UPI, as I'm probably going to refer it to, just save myself some time. So only one, Semyon Zolotarov, was not a student, but he was actually a ski and tour instructor who was recommended by the team, recommended to the team by the sports association that they had registered with for this expedition. So Semyon was hoping to achieve the rank of master or expert instructor with the experience from the trip. So you might be like, what is a sports association? Because I was wondering that. I was like, what do you mean they were registered with a sports association to take a hiking trip? You know what I mean? But apparently sports associations or clubs were really common for the time. And they just allowed people who shared interests like skiing to come together. Mm-hmm. And just if they wanted multiple people to join a group, that's how they were able to organize it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so all those that were involved in the expedition were grade 2 hikers with ski tour experience. And just for reference, a grade 3 hiker is the highest level of experience that one could be certified with in the Soviet Union. And to receive a grade 3 certification, candidates had to trek 190 miles or 300 kilometers to be granted that a grade 3 certification. That's a lot. So anyway, this group was hoping that upon their return that they would receive that grade 3 certification upon their arrival back. And so one thing that I was never really clear on was kind of like the general purpose mm-hmm. of this expedition. I wasn't sure if it was like for like geographic purposes, if they were trying to like get some... It was for research purposes, anything like that. But it really was the general purpose of the trip was just for the sake of adventure, right? Mm-hmm. Just so the Dyatlov group wanted to undertake the difficult excursion to challenge themselves, right? So the group wanted to take a trek to the mountain Gora Otorten and beyond. After reaching Otorten, the group planned to travel 100 kilometers south along the main ridge of the Ural Mountains to reach another peak called Ojkakal Peak. Do my best here. So after that, they planned to follow the northern Toshemka River and then passing 100 miles to the east of the town of Vishe. So that's a really big journey. It's a long journey. Mm-hmm. And at the time, so in the 50s and 60s, this route was one of the most difficult trips that could be undertaken. And in addition to this, the Dyatlov group planned to start their journey in February, which was estimated to be the most difficult time of year to travel on this mountain route.
So they were like, we're going to do the hardest thing at the hardest time of the year.
Yep. And they just wanted to really challenge themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, for sure. So... just to get a sense of what these hikers experience, I just want to take a little bit of a dive into what the weather conditions are like in this region at this particular time of year. So the northern Ural Mountains are considered a subarctic climate, which exhibits some pretty extreme seasonal variation. In the winter, the coldest months see temperatures that are nearly always below freezing. In fact, the town where the Dyatlov group started their trek has an average high for February of about 2 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 16 degrees Celsius. Hmm. Very cold. And precipitation normally isn't extreme at the lower elevations. However, like mountains, which they were trekking over mountains, are subjected to pretty sudden changes in weather, particularly when it comes to wind. Which can definitely make visibility really difficult when it is snowing. And also I want to say that the northern Urals, in the northern Urals, most mountains rise about 3,300 feet, which isn't too steep, but in the north, intensive weathering has caused mountain slopes and summits to be eroded into what people call, quote, bumpy seas of stone, so footing can be a little bit difficult. So it's very cold, can be very windy, visibility can be very difficult, very low whenever it's snowing, and granted, it's not, they're not gaining a whole lot of elevation, mm-hmm. but still, it is, the climate in general is rough.
Right.
So, in case it wasn't made perfectly clear, it was freaking cold, and when the group made their way to the town of Ivdel by train on January 25th, 1959, to start their journey. So, the following day, after arriving at Ivdel, they hopped a truck, north to the city of Visay, which is the last inhabited settlement before they began their 217-mile journey.
17. I'd be like, can we just round like round 15 up, or 20?
Or maybe just 200 miles. Or less. You know, if you're me, I am not that adventurous. But, you know, good for them. Like, it just makes me sick thinking about walking that many miles. So on the morning of January 27th, the group started their journey to that first stop, the Gora Otorten. And after a day of travel, one of the group members, Yuri Yudin, who suffered from rheumatism and a congenital heart defect, began experiencing some pretty intense knee and joint pain.
Scary, bro.
Yeah. That would totally be me.
Oh, me 100%. That was me literally yesterday.
Right? So, right from standing for 2 hours, that's me. I sit almost all day. Anyway, it's fine. So this pain left him unable to continue on the voyage, so he turned around while the other 9 hikers continued towards Gora Otorten by following the mountain valley and the river, as I mentioned earlier. So it's January 31st, and they reach the edge of a highland zone that breaks away from the river that they were following. And so they stopped here to prepare for the next day's climb. In a nearby wooded valley, the hikers left a cache of food and other supplies that were going to sustain them for the trip home. Okay? And so the next day, February 1st, the group started through the mountain pass. The way was steep and weather conditions were really rough, so there were snowstorms and decreasing visibility that ultimately slowed their pace down quite a bit. Based on the evidence from their diaries and from plans that they left with the sports association, they intended to get over the pass and make camp the next night on the opposite side of the mountain that they were traversing. However, likely due to the severe weather, they lost their way, only traveling 2.5 miles and deviating to the west towards the top of the mountain that's called Kolat Sikil. Sorry, people. I know it's rough. So after realizing their mistake, it's likely that the group just decided to set up camp right there on the slope of the mountain instead of moving a little less than a mile downhill to a forested area that provided shelter. Yuri Yudin, so the member that had turned back because of his pain, later speculated that, quote, Dyatlov probably did not want to lose the altitude that they had gained, or he decided to practice camping on a mountain slope. So that was the reasoning behind them not reaching that sheltered forested area. And on February 1st, the group was very tired. And the night was bitterly cold, like minus 18 degrees Celsius. So they ate dinner and just tried to settle in for the night. And I want to say that before leaving on the journey, Dyatlov had said that he would send a telegram to their sports association as soon as they arrived back in Visay. It was projected that he would send the telegram around February 12th. However, before heading home, Yudin was told by Dyatlov that they likely would take a little longer than originally expected, which was really common for these kinds of trips. So when February 12th passed with no word from the group back in Visay, no one was really panicked. Delays on such a trip were common, like I said. But by February 20th, the group had still not returned to Visay to send that telegram. And so this is when people really started to worry. And so Bailey's going to take over now talking about the search and rescue for the Dyatlov group.
Right on. So on February 20th of 1959, 8 days after their expected return date, relatives and friends of the Dyatlov party pressured the Ural Polytechnical Institute to dispatch a search and rescue group to find the young party of skiers slash hikers. This group consisted of teachers and volunteer students, but the institute's group initially failed to find any evidence of the Dyatlov party. As a result, the Russian army and Soviet police forces became involved in the search effort, with planes and helicopters both being dispatched to the area. A pilot was the first to make a sighting of something promising from the air. On February 26th, the search party found the abandoned camp on the eastern slope of Mountain 1079, Kolot Sakal, or Dead Mountain, named by the Mansi people who are, they're indigenous to the Ural Mountain area. Mm-hmm. Oh, fun fact, their language is also the official language along with Russian.
Oh, really?
Of Russia.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I thought that was nice. When they found the tent, they saw that it was obviously very damaged. Mikhail Sherevin, the student who found the tent, said, quote, "The tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind."
Mm.
End quote. They found a blanket and some rucksacks lined up neatly and a pile of boots in one corner. There was also the route map, official papers, money, and a flask of alcohol. Next to that, he spotted a plate full of salo. I hope that's how you pronounce it. It's a white pork fat, a Slavic delicacy, and the sort of high-calorie food that hikers took with them into the mountains.
That makes sense.
Quote, "It was sliced up as if they were getting ready to have supper or something and they didn't have time," end quote. And that's, again, from Sherevin, the student that found the tent.
Mm-hmm.
The search team found 9 tracks of footprints who were wearing socks, a single boot, or were barefoot.
Oh, my God.
That led to the edge of the woods on the opposite side of the pass. One and a half kilometers, almost a mile northeast.
Mm-hmm.
But snow covered the prints at 500 meters, or almost a third of the mile in. They wondered what on earth could have made the party leave their shelter semi-clad when it was at least negative 20 degrees Celsius outside.
Can you imagine being barefoot?
No.
At
the forest edge, under a large Serbian pine tree, they found the remains of a fire, along with the bodies of 2 of the Dyatlov party members, Georgi Yuri Krevenshenko and Yuri Doroshenko, without their shoes or any other article of clothing other than their underwear.
Mm.
They were found buried in snow. The branches of cedar under which they were lying were broken at a height of about 5 meters or 16 feet. On the trunk of the tree, traces of skin and other tissues were found. It's speculated that they climbed the tree and broke off branches until their hands were raw and bloody.
Oh.
Perhaps to climb to get branches for the fire, or potentially to get a view of their camp. As searchers continued, they came upon another body. 300 meters, almost 1,000 feet from the fire, and in the direction of the tent, searchers found party leader Igor Dyatlov. He was lying on his back with his head towards the tent, one hand holding a small birch tree branch and the other was shielding his head. 180 meters, 200 yards from the body of Igor Dyatlov and in the direction of the tent, the searchers found the body of Rustem Slobodin. He was lying face down in the snow. A further 150 meters, 160 yards from the body of Slobodin, and even closer to the tent, the searchers discovered the body of Zenadia Kolmogorova. From the position of her body, it seemed as if she was trying to desperately scramble back uphill towards the tent. Traces of blood were found nearby.
Percy. Oh, God.
Welcome back to the show, Perks.
It's been...
Oh, he's very sad.
He's sad because we're moving him.
I'm so sorry you can't be involved.
Get out of here,
okay,
Percy.
Please leave.
Please leave.
Please hold him.
Oh, God. All right. Come here, cat.
The searchers were still unable to find the remaining 4 party members. Nikolai, Thibault, Brunel, Semyon, Alexander Zolotarov, Ludmila Dubanina, and Alexander Kolovatov. That was until 3 months later when they were finally found under 4 meters or 13 feet of snow in a creek ravine, 75 meters or 246 feet further into the woods from the pine tree. Three of the four were heavier dressed than the others, and there were signs that those who died first had their clothes renounced to the others. Dubonina was wearing Kravchenko's burned, torn trousers, and her left foot and shin were wrapped in a torn jacket. Upon finding the bodies of Georgi Kravchenko, Yuri Doroshenko, Igor Dyatlov, Rustem Slobodin, and Zenadia Kolmogorova, a legal inquest began immediately. At the party's abandoned site, it was discovered that their tent was open from the inside with a knife. Investigators deduced quickly that something had alarmed the party as to rip open the tent to escape right away without taking their belongings and notably their shoes, which sat in a neat pile. Autopsies of the initially discovered party members didn't yield anything outlandish. Pathologists concluded that their cause of death was unanimously hypothermia. Slobodin had a small crack in his skull, but it was not thought to be a fatal wound, and Kravchenko had a knuckle injury that was believed to be from him actually biting it to stay conscious.
Oh, like causing pain so that he would stay awake.
You're probably aware that hypothermia is caused by prolonged exposure to very cold temperatures. According to the CDC, quote, when exposed to cold temperatures, your body begins to lose heat faster than it's produced. Lengthy exposures will eventually use up your body's stored energy, which leads to lower body temperature. Body temperature that is too low affects the brain, making the victim unable to think clearly or move well. This makes hypothermia especially dangerous because a person may not know that it's happening and won't be able to do anything about it. Oof. End quote. 25 to 50% of deaths by hypothermia are associated with paradoxical undressing. This typically occurs during moderate and severe hypothermia as the person becomes disoriented and confused. One explanation for the effect is a cold-induced malfunction of the hypothalamus, the part of the brain that regulates body temperature. Another explanation is that the muscles contracting peripheral blood vessels become exhausted and relax, leading to a sudden surge of blood and heat to the extremities, causing the person to feel overheated. An apparent self-protective behavior known as terminal burrowing or hide-and-die syndrome occurs in the final stages of hypothermia. The afflicted will enter small enclosed spaces. It is often associated with paradoxical undressing.
So they think that's why some of them were undressed, even though borrowed clothes?
I think that some speculate that could have happened, but I think it's pretty obvious that the others
used their clothing. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
I just thought it was
it is
interesting.
It is often mentioned. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But when the remaining bodies of Nikolai Thobo-Brunov and Simon Alexander Zolotarov, Ludmila Dubonina, and Alexander Kolovatov were found, things started to look a lot stranger. Thobo-Brunov had a fractured skull, his concluded cause of death. Alexander Kolovatov had a wound behind his ear and an oddly twisted neck, but it was said he died by hypothermia. Ludmila Dubonina and Simon Zolotarov had suffered multiple broken ribs. Simon had an open wound on the right side of his skull, which exposed bone. There was another gruesome detail. Both had empty eye sockets, and Lumilda's tongue was missing. Both of the hikers' death were caused by severe chest trauma and or internal bleeding caused by severe chest trauma.
So either way, severe chest trauma.
Yes.
Okay.
Journalists reporting on the available parts of the inquest files claim that it states, 1. Six group of party members died of hypothermia and 3 of fatal injuries. 2. There were no indicators of other people nearby on Kolosikol apart from the 9 travelers. 3. Victims died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal. 4 traces from the camp showed that all group members left the campsite of their own accord on foot. 5, some levels of radiation were found on only one victim's clothing. Side note, but due to some of the party working with radioactivity, this is likely a red herring.
Yeah.
Number 6, to dispel the theory of an attack by the indigenous Mansi people, V.A. Vajradeni, the forensic expert performing the postmortem examination, stated that the fatal injuries of the 3 bodies could not have been caused by human beings because, quote, because the force of the blows had been too strong and no soft tissue had been damaged, end quote. Released documents contained no information about the skier's internal organs.
Odd. So I guess, like, maybe, because we kind of talked about this, like, the no soft tissue damage, but damage to the inside, like, strong force.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just too great of a surface area for someone to be impacted by, like, a punch. Like, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that's so weird.
Mm-hmm. It is super weird. At the time, the verdict was the group had died because of a, quote, compelling natural force. The inquest officially ceased May 1959 as a result of the absence of a guilty party. Mm-hmm. The files were sent to a secret archive and remained classified until the 1980s. But, as with all tragic stories with no clear explanation, people have come up with their own theories.
Oh boy, have they.
Oh, have they.
Yeah, so there are so many theories, some more plausible than others.
Yeah.
Definitely. And so we're going to talk mostly about the ones that we think are actually plausible.
Right. So before we get into the theories, I just kind of want to give another brief summary of what the investigators found.
Yeah.
So they came across the tent on the side of Kolatshkov. Mm-hmm. The tent was half buried in snow. They had left a lot of really important belongings, most notably to me, their shoes.
The shoes, for
so,
sure.
And they had cut the tent from the inside.
So fleeing quickly.
Indicating that they needed to flee quickly without shoes or proper clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, with the exception of 3 hikers, died from hypothermia.
Yes.
A lot of the investigation focuses on the deaths of the 3 hikers who died from severe trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Chest trauma or the blow to the head.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because it's weird.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely weird. But there are some potential explanations, right?
Right.
Right. Let's say, is that all you wanted to summarize?
I think that kind of sums it up. Yeah. When we're going into the theories.
Yeah,
that,
why they focused on those 3 people in particular.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and the second party was found about 4 months later, mm-hmm, in May in a creek bed under, yes, I think it was 13 feet of snow.
A lot of snow.
Mm-hmm. So, with that in mind, under our mysterious circumstances, yeah, Beth is going to talk about our first couple theories.
Yeah. Oh, we got, oh, kitties. We got kitties making noise up in here. Okay, yeah. So the first popular theory is that of an avalanche, right? So this is a somewhat obvious theory, giving it a cursory thought, right? There's harsh, snowy conditions, and there's a camp that was on along the slope of the mountain, Kolatshkov. So while the force of an avalanche could certainly be that compelling natural force that the medical examiner described, there's some strong evidence against this theory, right? So the, mm-hmm, theory is that an avalanche came, that caught, they heard it coming, they rushed out of their tents, some got buried, but then it's like, anyway, we'll talk about why.
Everyone was found under a little bit of snow,
but the only people that are found under the deep snow are the people that were found months later, which makes sense, right? Okay, so there's a quote, an avalanche is unlikely due to the slope of the mountain they were on, the small amount of snow found on the tent, and this not being an avalanche prone area. So the footprints would have been wiped away. The group would not have been able to outrun an avalanche either. And this to me makes perfect sense because, as I talked about, the mountains are not very steep.
Right.
Not super steep. Yeah, the snow was the tent was only covered by a little bit of snow. How could you see footprints if there was an avalanche that was strong enough to kill these hikers, right? So that's pretty much what has debunked that theory so far.
And plus, if you think about the timeline where they, okay, say they hear an avalanche, so they're mm-hmm. rushing out into the tree area,
mm-hmm.
the wooded area. you have the hikers who died of the physical trauma.
Mm-hmm.
We know that they removed clothing from
those hikers.
From the dead hikers. Mm-hmm. So we know that they died after.
Yes.
At mm-hmm. least after the first two
mm-hmm.
Victims that were found.
Yeah.
So if it... what? Like,
yeah,
what?
Why would they stop and undress them during an avalanche? Like...
Yeah.
That to me doesn't make any sense. So that leads to our next theory, which is the theory of katabatic wind. So this one's really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah. So a katabatic wind is a type of drainage wind. So it is a wind that carries high density air from a higher elevation down a slope under the force of gravity. Katabatic winds can rush down elevated slopes at hurricane speeds, but most are not as intense as that, and many are just around 10 knots, which is 800 kilometers per hour or less. So not that intense sometimes, but they can be, right? So in 2019, a Swedish-Russian expedition was made to the site, and after investigations, they proposed that a violent katabatic wind is a likely explanation for the incident. Katabatic winds are somewhat rare events, but they can be extremely violent. They were implicated in the 1970 case at Anaris Mountain in Sweden, where 8 hikers were killed and 1 was seriously injured in the aftermath of a katabatic wind. And so the topography of these locations were noted to be very similar, according to the expedition. So a sudden and violent katabatic wind would have made it nearly impossible to remain in the tent. And the most rational course of action would be for the hikers to cover the tent with snow and seek shelter among the tree line. There was also a torch left turned on top of the tent, possibly left there intentionally so the hikers could find their way back to the tent once the winds subsided. The expedition proposed that the group of hikers constructed 2 temporary shelters, one of which collapsed, leaving 4 of the hikers buried with the violent injuries that were observed. Supposedly, all of the footprints leading away from the tent and towards the woods were consistent with individuals who were walking at a pretty normal pace, like not a rush pace. And one would think that with hurricane force winds that their tent would have blown away. But maybe that's why snow was on it, or maybe wind had pushed snow on top of the tent.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some things that kind of make the katabatic wind theory a little bit iffy.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note about the footprints,
the slow pace,
consistent mm-hmm. with being at a slow pace. We were only able to find that information on one source.
Yeah, so take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. why we haven't mentioned it previous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think there is good evidence for katabatic wind. Mm-hmm. If you kind of ignore that one comment about the footprints, similar to the incident that happened in Sweden. Yeah, and so I think that one's a good one. So Bailey's going to go ahead and take over the last theory, and one that is wildly popular because it has a... You go ahead and get into it, Bailey.
All right, well, okay. So who doesn't love a good government conspiracy theory, especially a Soviet-era one?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, the world, especially America, has this kind of... We have this idea of Soviet-era Russia and their lying and scheming and secretive. And
a lot of that's due to propaganda.
Yeah, they did a good job of keeping their shit secret, except Chernobyl, because they couldn't.
Yeah, because that, no.
This theory proposes that the group's campsite could have been in the path of Soviet Union parachute mine exercises.
Mm-hmm.
The hikers could have woken up by loud noises and fled the tent in a panic. Mm-hmm. After some members froze to death, the others could have tried to salvage their clothes, but eventually succumbed to injuries from the parachute mines.
Mm-hmm. So that's what they're thinking happened, why those three had,
mm-hmm.
had three or two?
It's three.
Three had those traumatic injuries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So according to Keith McCloskey in his 2013 book, Mountain of the Dead, the Dyatlov Pass incident, there are records of parachute mine testing going on in the area at around the same time that the hikers were undertaking their expedition. Mm-hmm. Parachute mines detonate while still in the air, apparently producing injuries that cause heavy internal damage with less external damage, similar to the injuries sustained by Dumanina and Zolotarov, severe chest trauma without soft tissue damage.
Still confusing to me, but I'm not a medical examiner.
True that. Some say the radiation found on Krivonchenko is evidence for this theory, or theories of radiological
experiments.
Testing in the area. But Krivonchenko actually worked with radioactivity, and he actually helped clean up a plutonium plant leak. Finding radioactivity on his clothes and body, it's really not surprising.
Especially in the levels that they found it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was significant enough to, raise a flag, but not enough where it's just not consistent with high levels of... Mm-hmm. Radiological weapons.
Yeah, exactly. And then it was only really him and his clothing that had it.
Right. So, it's also been said that other hikers nearby were witness to, quote, lights in the sky. They reported seeing glowing and falling orange lights in the vicinity of the Dyatlov group. Mm-hmm. Further, the initial concealment of the investigation reports led some to speculate that there was that this was to cover up any evidence of parachute mine testing.
Or any other
or
radiological type testing. Yeah.
Right. However, keeping reports sealed to the public was common practice for any domestic investigation during this time in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually in the 1980s, the investigation files were released.
Yes.
It is the one thing that we thought that was a little weird, but it could just coincide with the secrecy and kind of hush-hush of the Soviet Union, was that the government forced all but two of the group members to be buried in the same place.
Yeah, against their family's wishes.
Mm-hmm. And two of them, Semyon and Zolotarov and Georgi Yuri Krivonchenko were buried together in a different cemetery.
I thought they were buried separately.
They're buried in the same cemetery, but separate from the rest of the
group. Okay, I thought you... Okay, see what you're saying.
Yeah, so there's a little weirdness with the funeral and the burial and how... government officials, along with the Ural Polytechnical Institute, handled the funerals. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we found anything that couldn't be explained by normal
climate at the time.
Exactly, yeah. Normal government hush hush. Do what we say, or you're against the country.
Exactly.
Not wanting to make a big deal about it, especially since they didn't. Find a conclusive reason.
Yeah, so that could be one, just be an explanation of kind of the odd behavior on the part of the government when it came to the funeral, which some kind of point to the fact think that there's some mysterious government cover up, but I think it was just a lot of them just trying to not admit their failure and trying to get past the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is actually interesting because the investigation into the Dyatlov Pass incident was reopened in 2019. So we're not going to go into it too deeply, but just want to give you a really bit of a brief outline of just what's been going on there and what their ultimate conclusion was.
Mm-hmm. Prosecutor's office in Russia in 2018 sought to reopen the investigation into the Dyatlov Pass incident, but was initially denied by the Russian courts. Mm. The very next month, the prosecutor's office at the Sverdlovsk region, so sorry, Russian and everyone, yep, all of our listeners, I'm so sorry. Initiated a new investigation. In March of 2019, the prosecutor's office undertook an expedition to Dyatlov Pass to test three theories: an avalanche, a snow slab avalanche, and a hurricane.
Which I think they mean like the katabatic wind, like, associated with that, right? Maybe? Like, I think they mean hurricane force winds.
I mean, it has to be, I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you're right, like, it does go in with the like, really, really horrible winds. I mean, even in the katabatic mm-hmm. wind description, it's hurricane, it can be, like, hurricane force winds.
Exactly. I think that the website we looked at for a summary of the investigation kind of just lumped that.
No, I mean, I know that we looked at that one website for this section, yeah, but I saw it multiple places where it said hurricane.
Okay.
So let me just finish this section and then we can
speculate,
talk about that more. But in January 2020, the Prosecutor General Yuri Chatka was fired and replaced by Igor Krasnov. 7 months later, in July, Andriy Kirikov, deputy head of the regional prosecutor's office, announced that a conclusion had been reached, that the hikers had passed away due to an avalanche, or, quote, extensive force.
Mm-hmm. So kind of what they thought in the initial mm-hmm. investigation.
But, interestingly, Igor Krasnov reprimanded Kirikov, stating that the investigation participated in, quote, incomplete official compliance, which is no slap on the wrist. It's the max punishment before being fired. So we'll see what happens next. We're not sure if that's going to change the report or not, but it's very interesting.
It kind of made it seem like the report was too rushed, or they didn't talk with Krasnov before they opened their mouths about the official findings. I'm really curious to see if that's actually going to influence the findings. But so far, it hasn't. But who knows what the future will tell.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So they say case closed and that it was an avalanche. I don't know.
I need to see science. Like, I guess
I need
just
to see more. Yeah.
I just haven't seen any science to back up.
Yeah, maybe that'll be released in the coming months that will show exactly why they think that. Mm-hmm. I understand why they want to keep it, like, somewhat under wraps, like, while things are still being sort of fleshed out. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, I think that katabatic wind makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And because there was a really similar incident, and we did have that survivor that could talk to investigators, that one just seems the most plausible to me. But again, I've never been there, don't know what mm-hmm. it's like. Just based on the evidence, that's what I think.
I think, is this snow monster?
Oh, do you know?
That's what, when I remember being younger and hearing about it and just hearing about how, you know, these, the hikers had, they scrambled out of their tent, they cut their tent open to, you know, escape on barefoot into the wind. And then some of the hikers, when I was younger, I don't remember the hypothermia, but mm-hmm. probably because the, you know, the traumatic deaths were more, they're more violent.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's like, oh, well, they couldn't be caused by humans. So what else could it be?
I know. My very uninformed opinion when I was little was, like, aliens.
Yeah, monsters.
Or some type of... Yeah, my very uninformed opinion as a kid was just like, it has to be like aliens or a monster, because I knew literally nothing of the true facts. And I think a lot of times that's what people just think of when they think of this incident. Like, they associate with this, like,
with paranormal.
Yeah. And that's just, it's just not the case.
I mean, as you know, a child, I definitely was like, if it wasn't a human,
then it had to be something either paranormal or extraterrestrial. Yeah, so I was actually really happy that we got to do this dive into this investigation, because honestly, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, and mm-hmm. it's more interesting. And yeah, like, you have to remember that these were people, and mm-hmm. this wasn't just something that happened to them. They had more than this was right. more. And so I'm really happy that we got this chance to go into this mysterious incident. And
yeah, absolutely, because I'd personally never heard of the Kabatic Wind. Yeah. And that is a terrifying way to potentially go, being thrown around by the wind. I think that, though, in my heart of hearts, it's like, I don't know why. I know, and maybe this is like a really ill-informed like thought, mm-hmm. but what if the group just fell into the ravine
and
sustained injuries, and then they ended up getting
hypothermia,
buried by the snow? Like, I mean, because he hit his head.
Uh-huh.
One hiker hit his head, the other mm-hmm. had severe chest trauma, and the third hiker, I mean, she sustained severe chest trauma, but that said that she died from internal bleeding.
Yeah, maybe I think that's possible, but maybe that is kind of like lumped in with the details of maybe like avalanche or catabatic wind.
Of being pushed down into
a ravine. Yeah, it's possible. It's possible that, you know, being blinded by heavy winds and snow, you can't see where you're going, it's mm-hmm. confusing, it's stressful. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we're ever gonna know exactly what happened, obviously, but there are some really good theories, and that make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
They make absolutely a lot of sense, just kind of like going over it with a fine-tooth comb and figuring out mm-hmm. which is the most plausible.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was a little bit of a long one.
Yeah,
because there was a lot.
I mean, honestly, I think we both had to keep telling each other, like, enough.
Yeah.
Okay, make it short. Okay, like,
we have summarize to summarize
this. Because there's just so much to this story, and
mm-hmm.
you know, like, any living human being, the hikers and students were, you know, complex
individuals. And
in one reference I did want to let you guys know, if you wanted to find out a whole lot more information
about them, mm-hmm.
is actually dyatlovpass.com.
Mm-hmm.
The Dyatlov Pass Foundation was founded, I believe, by Yuri Yudin, the hiker who mm-hmm.
Had to leave
who left early, and so he was the only surviving party member.
Mm-hmm.
But dyatlovpass.com has a lot of different resources. They have a lot of different theories that we didn't cover, like the Yeti, which is a pretty popular one,
which is sad.
I just never have been afraid of the Yeti. I don't know why.
Yeah,
it's just not scary to me. I just feel like a Yeti wouldn't want to just kill people.
Yeah, I've never, you know, of all the stuff we believe, I've never believed in an, like, abominable snowman.
I don't know. I'm like, Bigfoot? Sure. Yeti? No.
Hey, there's no snowy cousin of the Bigfoot. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I just like to think that, like, Yetis and Bigfoot creatures are just chill, and they hide from people, and they're not going to come and, like, crush mm-hmm. someone's chest.
Not, like, seeking, like, to act violent. Yeah, I feel that way, too. If they're real, that's what I'd like to imagine. But,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Our hot take on that.
I think I'm going off in different tangents. But anyway, dyatlovpass.com, excellent resource. You can find diary entries mm-hmm. from the hikers. You can find photos that the hikers actually took on their journey, and just so much more information than we could possibly cover
into one of our episodes. Yeah,
absolutely. So we definitely recommend doing further reading, if it interests you. Come up with your own
theory.
You know, what do you think? Maybe we didn't delve into one theory in depth enough
that you're particularly fond of.
Let us know if we missed any pertinent information.
Yeah, because there's a lot.
There is a lot to sift through. So thanks for struggle busting through all of those pronunciations with us.
Oh my god, I even like pronunciation guides, like I just get tripped up when I read the names. I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm so sorry. We really did try. And so let us know if we mispronounce anything. We're very sorry.
Well, if you let us know, which I know we pronounce things wrong. Well, so you are more than welcome to definitely let us know that. But
and
also,
then we can maybe mention it in the next ep.
Yeah. Maybe if you could provide with some correct pronunciations.
Yeah.
Or somewhere we can access them.
Yeah. Because I did look up some pronunciation guides.
Oh, so did I. Yeah.
It's... Yeah, so that was a hard part about reading our notes today. But yeah, thank you so much, like Bailey said, for kind of diving into this investigation with us. It was a lot. I know there was a lot of moving parts. And so, Bailey, I think you did a great job of breaking down the investigation and what they found, and that helpful summary before the theories was great.
Yeah, it's a lot of information to process all at once.
For sure.
So, well, thank you again for going on this journey with us. And we will see you, we'll talk to you. We'll talk at you.
Talk at you.
In a few weeks.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Love you, bye.
Two Creepy Bees is edited by Tyler Lidwell Videography. Theme music composed by Thomas Obernesser. If you enjoy this podcast and all things creepy, you can find us on your favorite listening forum, where if you want to support us, you can like, review, and subscribe. Check out Two Creepy Bees on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest. You can also drop us an email at twocreepybeespodcast@gmail.com. And finally, check out our website at twocreepybees.com. And remember, keep it creepy.